Humanology is a new book which takes the reader on a journey across centuries and galaxies to answer some burning questions about life and existence itself, and to mark some of the scientific milestones covered in the book, because there is a lot of history in the book. I'm joined by the author, Luke O'Neill. Luke, you're very welcome.
Thanks, Miles.
As it relates to your own institution of a Trinity College, where you're professor of biochemistry, we're going to start, though, with a very significant anniversary, which you marked in particular earlier this month. 75 years since Erwin Schrödinger gave his famous What is Life lectures. I think there were three of them altogether. Remind us about how Schrödinger ended up, because it's an extraordinary story, ended up in Ireland in the first place.
It's very strange, isn't it? Yes, Eamon de Valera, it's the best thing he did, we think, for Ireland, by the way, probably.
You know, definitely one of them, there's no doubt about it.
Yeah, he sets up the Institute for Advanced Studies, which is still there, by the way, DS they call it, the initials. And he gets in Schrödinger to be the first director, which is a great example of headhunting. Here's a Nobel Prize winning physicist who's world famous, and he attracts him to Ireland. And then Schrödinger, in 1943, for some reason, gives lectures on biology, even though he's a physicist. And he asks the question, what is life from a physics point of view? And he talks about what becomes DNA, really. And we see these lectures as the start of the DNA revolution. And all the luminaries, Watson and Crick and all these guys, they read the book on the lectures. And it's really famous, you know, the history of DNA research mainly. And we did the 75th anniversary to mark this.
And he had the credibility as a physicist to give three lectures on biology.
Not really. No, he was very cautious. In the foreword of the book, he goes, this is a bad idea, I'm straying into a different subject here, you know. But yet again, advances often happen when you mix disciplines, you see. And he was a physicist now addressing biology. And that influenced physicists to go in. Crick was a physicist, for example, you know. So these people went into biology because of Schrödinger's lead, in a sense. So they see it as a good example, you know, of science advancing, sort of left field stuff coming into a field and progressing the whole thing forward there.
You have an interesting photograph in the book, and it's you and Watson of Watson and Crick. And this is not a Watson as in Watson and Sherlock Holmes. They were equal partners, weren't they?
They were indeed. Yeah, I met him about 10 years ago in Cambridge. I did a postdoc in Cambridge, you see, many years ago, and so did he. And I said to him, I think your postdoc was a bit more successful than mine. You discovered the secret of life. Well, he discovered the DNA double helix. And I met him and I said, do you want to go for a pint? And he said, yeah. So I took him to the very pub, the Eagle pub, where they announced one day when they got the double helix of DNA, we've got the secret of life, you know. And I sat at the very table, they made the DNA, so he sat at a pint, me and Watson, wasn't it marvellous?
Absolutely. Now, something else I want to talk to you about, we will talk about the book in a moment, or aspects, elements of the book, the historical elements of the book, but this coming week sees the anniversary of a very important scientific discovery, as important to a lot of people as the discovery of DNA, because they wouldn't be walking the planet were it not for this discovery. And that was Friday the 28th of September. It's going to be 90 years since Alexander Fleming discovered penicillin with, am I correct in saying this, the aid of his own snot?
Yes, well, sort of. Yeah.
Sort of.
That's right. He was sneezing into things a lot. Yeah, but it's a very important anniversary. That discovery has saved hundreds of millions of lives, remember, because of antibiotics. And if penicillin hadn't been discovered, millions would have died in the Second World War. That's the first place to begin to use it, you know. So it's a good one to commemorate, really, the discovery of penicillin.
There was an Irish connection. His wife was Irish, wasn't
his
she?
Wife was Irish. I think it was Brigine, yes. But more importantly, the famous story goes, a bit of mould blew in his window, into his lab, and landed on this dish of bacteria and killed them. And you wonder, what is that mould, right? And the guys whose lab it blew in from was an Irish guy called Latouche, who are famous Huguenots, by the way, as you know. A guy called Latouche was working over in the same hospital as Fleming. It was his mould that blew in the window. So really, we should claim antibiotics as Irish, I think, because of that serendipitous event.
One of the Wicklow Latouches.
The Wicklow Latouches, yeah.
And
you see,
Latouche.
Fleming was clever, went to see the guy. He said, you're an expert on fungus. What's this stuff? And Latouche goes, that's penicillin. And then, you know, Fleming realised this is something in penicillin that's actually penicillium was the name of the mould that's actually responsible for killing the bacteria, and that was the discovery of penicillin. So there is an Irish angle on that one as well.
And many people listening today would not be listening today were it not for Alexander Fleming and penicillin. To just talk a little bit about the historical aspects and elements of the book, it's more prehistory as much as it is history. Early in the book you mention, if I may be parochial, two Irishmen who played very different roles in establishing the age of the planet which we occupy. One was Archbishop Usher,
yep.
and the other was John Jolie, who was a professor in your own institution, Trinity College. One of them was quite a bit out. The other one was a lot closer in terms of getting the age right. Explain.
Yeah, they were both a bit out, turns out.
Well,
but,
yeah.
But Usher gets the credit for the first systematic attempt to age the Earth, right? Now, this is a big question in science. How old is the Earth, you know? And he goes to the library. In those days, there were things called libraries, apparently, where people went and read things, you know, got the Bible, the main book, and he used systematic dating back, basically, all through the genealogies. And he says the Earth was created on the 22nd of October, 4004 BC. And it's from 6 p.m. to midnight, he says, is when God creates everything, right?
So that took half a day's work.
As I say in the book, so you wouldn't even binge watch Game of Thrones in that time now. But he creates the entire Earth in that period. And hey, presto, the Earth is now. And that goes into the King James Bible. And up to the 1800s, people really believed that the Earth was 6,000 years old.
There are still people who believe the Earth, unfortunately, is 6,000 years old.
Sadly, there are. And they believed it because a clever guy tried to figure it out using something systematic. I mean, even though we look back now, it's preposterous. It was an attempt to age the Earth,
then
you see.
John Jolie was a professor of geology, so he uses a different system.
He was. And again, the next step in the history is a Trinity story, right, Miles? The next attempt is Jolie. He says the Earth's about 80 million years old, which is a big difference, you see. And that caused consternation at the time because most people thought it was 6,000 years old. How can the Earth be millions of years old? And he was using how salty the oceans are. So if they begin fresh and rocks get dissolved, it might take 80 million years to make them salty. That was his attempt, you know. Now, he's out by a lot. It's 4.5 billion years old is how old the Earth is. But still, to make it millions and millions was seen as a big advance at the time.
He definitely got closer than Archbishop Usher anyway. One interesting chapter title, I love the chapter title, is Why Sex with a Caveman Was a Good Idea. Explain, please.
Well, you see, the best history really was of humanity, isn't it? Let's face it, you know. And we begin in Africa 200,000 years ago is when Homo sapiens, our species, evolve. And then they move into Europe, you see. And 100,000 years ago, they're in the Middle East. They managed to get as far as that. And they begin to go into Europe maybe 40, 50,000 years ago. And they meet cavemen, the Neanderthals, who are another species of Homo like us, but they're a bit different. And the big question is, did we have sex with them or not? And that was disputed for a long time. And then a guy called Svante Paabo gets some Neanderthal DNA and realises we carry some of their genes. So that means we must have had procreation with the cavemen and they gave us certain traits. So it looks like it's for definite that we go into Europe and we have sex with cavemen because these are seen as a slightly more primitive type of Homo, I suppose, is the way to think of it.
And then we dispose of them, do we?
Well, it's like the Black Widow spider, as I say, as we have sex with them and we kill them. So they get wiped out. And the last remnants are in the south of Spain. They find a few bones there. So they all die off. Now we mightn't have killed them. We might have just overpopulated, you know, and they would have been compromised because we've
so it's
too
like
many
the red squirrel and the grey squirrel.
It could be that, or we did actually kill them. They're the two options. But there's no doubt they get wiped out and there's none left, you see.
Another chapter looks at the biggest machines ever built. What were the biggest machines ever built?
Yeah, this is my favourite chapter by myself, actually, because it's through collaboration between scientists. Isn't it fantastic? Yeah. So the biggest machine ever built is the International Space Station. It's up orbiting the Earth as we speak. You can see with the naked eye. It shoots across the sky, you know. It's cost $150 billion to build. Can you believe this space station is up there? And the Russians and the Americans collaborated. And it's a wonderful place for science. It's studying gravity. It's, you know, it's, lots of stuff is happening up there to do with space science and space biology. So that's the most expensive machine ever built, I guess we call that one. And then
what
the
about
other
the Hadron
one,
Collider?
That's the biggest one, actually,
right.
Yeah. So that one is firing protons into each other and it goes around the Swiss-French border. It's a CERN built that, this place called CERN. And there's one experiment, smashing protons together, to ask a very simple question, what's matter made of? What's the stuff that, you know, things are made of? And they find, remember the famous Higgs boson is discovered there 6 years ago? So that's another example. That was a bit cheaper, but it's the biggest machine ever built.
How much did that cost?
That cost, I think, about $50 billion, something like that. It's still expensive, yeah. But what's great is that there's 10,000 scientists working together in that place. Isn't it wonderful? So all collaborating and trying to find out the secrets of matter itself. So I love that one as an example of what science should be about, you know.
Okay. The book is called Humanology. It is a wonderful read. It's also, might I say, a beautifully produced book by Gill Books. They've done you proud. It's wonderfully, wonderfully illustrated. And you can see a photograph of O'Neill and Watson outside the Cambridge pub with O'Neill pointing at a blue plaque above the heads of these two great scientists. Luke O'Neill, thank you very much indeed for joining us on the History Show this evening.